My name is Gene Swihart. I first heard of Holden Village. I'm going to give you a little history of myself in order to make clear what Holden Village meant to me and the changes that it made in the lives of me and my family. I was an adult convert and in the mid-30s joined the ELC Mission Church, the only one in the state of Oklahoma. I had known the Rudy Edmonds, Doris and Rudy, for some time, and when she was instrumental in starting the new church, I joined it. Dr. Meyer was a member of the board of LBI practicing in Oklahoma City, and he first told me of their acquisition. I had been, before my marriage, a licensed guide of the Rocky Mountain National Park, and when I heard that Holden was in the mountains and the type of place that it was, I knew that it was a place I had to visit. I wrote to Gilbert, who explained that in the summer of 62, they were simply having work crews, and it would be the following year before they would have any program. I told the Edmonds about Holden, and the Lundholms had also mentioned it to them, so when they came to the World's Fair in Seattle, they went up for the weekend. They mentioned my name while they were up there, and Doris suggested that I would take over the children's activities. I was very excited the following January to get a letter from Gil inviting me to come for the summer. So I had two grown sons who were otherwise occupied, a husband who had a business to run. So I started off with my 12-year-old daughter, and we drove from Oklahoma City to Holden. Not knowing what to expect, I brought all of the camping equipment, tents, cook stoves, everything with me, along with my daughter's large accordion. And when we unloaded at the dock of 25 Mile Creek, we ended up having 24 pieces. We were the only people there. It was late in May. The boatman asked, after looking at the dock with all of these pieces of luggage strung the entire length of it, where the rest of the people were, and I rather sheepishly said, "We're it." However, they very kindly loaded us on, and we went. I don't believe that there is a thrill compared to the first time one arrives at Holden Village, at least for me. Here were my beloved mountains, only more beautiful than those I had ever seen in Colorado. And as the bus turned the corner and we saw the tailings, all I could think of was, what are the wheat fields of Oklahoma doing up here in the mountains? Then I realized what it was. We were, needless to say, one of the first to arrive, and Gil immediately put us to work. Fortunately, I liked doing carpentry and odd jobs and clearing trail and what have you. In fact, Beanie Lundholm later said the first time he ever saw me, I was up on the roof of Chalet 11 pounding shingles. And that was the way things were then. Everyone did a little bit of everything, including their jobs, which didn't take all that long. I've heard some of the tapes of Holden, and to me, you do find mountains everywhere, but to me, Holden Village is people, and this was what always was the predominant factor to me. It was the first time in my life I had ever known real community. I'd been raised in a city where one hardly knew one's neighbors. We had very little family. And to discover what community really was probably the most startling and lasting thing that happened to me in Holden Village. I started in organizing the children's activities, and having been a scout master and so on, I immediately got them outside. We collected animal prints, we collected wildflowers, we went on nature hikes, we went up to the ballpark every Thursday night and cooked s'mores over the fire and had lemonade and learned to make cold catches in the stream, put our breakfast things in there, and played flashlight tag. This wore the children out completely, plus hauling wood for the fire. And to further assure that they would go to sleep when they got in their bedrolls, I told them no one could go to sleep until they'd seen three falling stars. One night, along about midnight, I heard this sleepy little boy's voice saying, "Gene, do satellites count? I'm sleepy." Early in June, our new director arrived, Carol Hinderly. I was used to people like Gil because he was a businessman and my life had been spent among business people, but I had never known anyone like Carol. Even after 20-odd years in the church, I still have never met anyone like Carol. It took me a while to realize the absolute genius of the man. He put a stamp on Holden that I hope will remain forever. He enabled us, through his own personal honesty, his own sense of freedom in the gospel, to be free. The masks dropped. We were ourselves, and we found that being ourselves was thoroughly enjoyable as well as acceptable. Then the faculty began to arrive, and the young people. Again, I had never known women like the women who came to Holden Village. There was Doris Edmond, of course. There were Beanie and Gertrude Lundholm. There was, Gertrude and Fritz Norstad. I don't remember whether the Hongs were there the first year, but they were there early on, and it was a great privilege to get to know Edna. She loved camping out, cooking over an open fire. She would accompany me down to the trout stream and write in her beautiful book of poetry while I caught trout for dinner. Rudy and I were pretty much the trout fishermen of the village, and we'd save them up, and then we'd have a big fish fry. We were quite short of equipment then. For instance, there were no paper napkins, so I think this was Gertrude Lundholm's idea, we would take two squares of toilet paper, fold them, make flowers in the upper left-hand corner, and those were our napkins for the fish fries. The Vern Rieckes came. Armin Grams and his wife were there. Fern Olson came and became our housekeeper. Merton and Irene Strumman, refreshing. And the children were just so alive, so curious. They were like sponges in absorbing everything they could about nature and the village and being a part of the community. Carol often said there's no age in the kingdom, and many of these children who had been unable to know their grandparents very well, if at all, soon became attached to the senior citizens there, the older people, and these were the surrogate grandparents and parents. We were, in essence, one family. Each of the children was loved by each of the adults, and vice versa. Wes Preeb was also there, and it was a treat to get to know Wes. The guests at Holden were rather scarce in those days. We cordially welcomed everyone who came up and immediately made them a part of the village. But most of the guests left on Sunday afternoon, and they didn't come in until Monday afternoon. And so we organized a ladies' wildflower club. I had been collecting wildflowers and putting them up all over the village, starting with the dining room. And so I went up to Carol at the mic one Monday morning, and I said, "The ladies' wildflower club will be hiking to Heart Lake this afternoon." And Carol got it a little mixed up. It came out, "The Wild Ladies Flower Club will hike to Heart Lake." That's what it remained from then on. Another thing were the grounds of Holden. They had been sadly neglected. And the women, while the mine was in operation, had rather vied with one another in collecting wildflowers, which was a great idea to, rather than make Holden look like suburbia, they collected wildflowers from all over the United States, wherever they came from or went to visit when they went out. And they had planted them all over, so it was fun restoring these beds and putting the wildflowers there. I know Gertrude and one or two others took a wagon up to Honeymoon Heights and dug up a good many things up there from the deserted town and brought them down and planted them in the village. But the first summer was really cold. It was absolutely the coldest summer I have known from that time to this. And there was no heat in the village at all. We were fortunate to even have plumbing and electricity. So we would go down to the center in the evening for Vespers, and each of us dragging our old, somewhat moth-eaten blankets left over from the mining days, and wrap up in the blankets to sit on the benches to worship in the evening service. I went three summers, just my daughter and myself, and while I'm there, I might say that I didn't realize what was happening with my daughter. This was her first experience with people of this caliber, and even at 12, she was thoroughly entranced. I remember one woman saying, "Well, there's a program for the little children, and there's a program for adults, but what do I do with my 14-year-old son?" And I said without thinking, "Well, he could go in and sit at the lecture next to my 12-year-old daughter who's taking notes." I feel quite sure that it was her exposure at Holden that inspired her to go on into college and graduate work. She had not known women who had written books, who were college professors, who were accomplishing things in the world other than being mothers and housewives. It was quite a revelation to her, and I'm sure quite an inspiration. We were there for the first three summers in pretty much the same capacity, and then I had to miss a summer due to my husband's illness, and the following summer he came with us. He immediately took over the landscaping, planted the window boxes, hung hanging baskets, brought boxes of pansies with him and planted them all over, and fed the lawns and so on with a crew of young people with him, and transformed the entire looks of the village. After one summer there, he was quite sure that they could not function without him. Going back to the first summer, I realized that many of the guests were not there long enough to see much of the wildlife, so I collected a few animals that I was able to catch and established a little zoo. Up on the tailings, there were pollywogs who turned into great northern toads, and the children and I would collect them and bring them down and put them in a fish tank. I remember one little girl who was so eager to see the pollywogs turn into toads, and she was leaving the following Sunday. Every morning I came into the schoolroom, and her little nose was pressed against the cage because I had told her the first thing that would happen was they would sprout hind legs. The day she left on Sunday, she raced down early in the morning, pressed her nose against the glass and looked in, and here were a couple of pollywogs with their hind legs just beginning to sprout. And she turned to me with her face beaming and said, "Oh, gee whiz, God, thanks a lot." This somewhat expressed to me everyone's feeling about Holden. It was a gee whiz, God kind of thing. The worshiping became so much a part of our everyday lives. We had great Beanie Sings in the dining hall. We wrote songs. We had morning matins. And it just started the day and held the day in the hands of the Lord for us. And we became so aware of His magnificent presence among us. One of the things that we captured was a porcupine, and I was especially proud of him because people heard a lot about porcupines since they did so much damage to the forests, and you could see where they'd been, but not too many people actually came upon one. So I ran around in the basements of the chalets in one place and another and came up with enough pipe to build a cage, and then found some wire to put around it. It had to be pretty sturdy because porcupines can eat their way out of most anything. And finally, after about a week or 10 days, Reuben, who was the caretaker of the village and who stayed there in the winters alone for the first few years, said, "Gene, I'm sorry," he said, "I've got plumbing to repair, and you've got the only pipe left in the whole village in that cage. I'm going to have to dismantle it." So we had to let the porcupine go and use the cage to repair the plumbing. One summer early on, my husband and I took over the kitchen. He had owned restaurants most of his life, and something had happened to the cooks that were scheduled to come, so we stayed there for 6 months that summer, which is the longest I've been at Holden. It's amazing to see the village change from the small winter crew into the larger village and then diminish again into the fall group. Of course, now there is a winter program, which they didn't have then. I remember Reuben saying that he had 5 pairs of skis. He would ski down the 11 miles of mountain once a month to Lucerne to pick up supplies and retrieve his mail and one thing and another, leave the skis down there, and then snowshoe back the following day up the 11 miles. And then in the spring, he'd go back down and collect all of his skis and bring them up on the bus. In those days, we had no winter transportation, and that was his only method of getting out. Werner ran the kitchen the first summer, and he had worked his way through Purdue, as I understand, doing the same thing. So at the end of the summer, Carol was mentioning to me that before he went back to Minneapolis, he would like to find someone who lived locally in the area who could be the liaison man for the village between him and what was going on there and on the West Coast. And I just casually suggested Werner. He had taken a leave of absence from Boeing and as an aeronautical engineer. And I thought since he had done that, he might be willing to simply continue his absence from his profession. It was a far-out idea, but I threw it out anyway. And then several times during that day, I happened to pass groups Carol was talking to, and he was talking about Werner possibly becoming the business manager for Holden. I thought maybe I'd best mention to Werner what I had instigated here, and so that afternoon I looked him up and told him something of what was happening, and he said, well, he didn't know anything about being a business manager, and I said, well, neither does anybody else, but Carol had not approached him. And that evening at dinner, Carol got on the microphone and announced that Werner was the new business manager. He still hadn't gotten around to talking to Werner about it.
For that project.
One of the people of whom I hold the fondest memories was Mary Hinderly. One became aware of her somewhat gradually because Carol was such a predominant personality. But I had never known that women could be theologians. I thought that was strictly a man's province. It was such a treat to talk with her, to find the depth of her reading, her research, her thinking, to hear her preach. It was just a revelation to get to know this marvelous woman. One of the other things in which I was quite active was the drama of the village. We, of course, had our 4th of July celebrations with our 4th of July speeches. We had dedications of various projects that we had completed. The first, I believe, was the sauna. There was an old vegetable bin in the village dug into the side of a hill behind the kitchen. And Carol, being the Norsky that he is, immediately put it to use as a sauna. I had not known what a sauna was, being a Welshman from Oklahoma, but I soon became as addicted to them as the native Norwegians. We would often have town hall meetings in the evenings with, say, an economist, a lawyer, and a theologian, all approaching the same subject, such as the future of the inner city. And we would become so heated in our discussion that we would continue it until often 2 a.m. in the morning in the sauna, giving one another back rubs and arguing heatedly about what had occurred in the meetings. Another thing that somehow at noon on the 25th of July, the staff got together and decided that what we should have at Holden was Christmas. And since it was the 25th of July, that was a good day to do it. So that evening we had Christmas with a tree, decorations, Christmas carols, trumpets, the whole bit. It was amazing, the talent at Holden. Armin Grams, for instance, was the author of a book, Children and Their Parents. He was a child psychologist. And he had worked his way through college as an electrician. So he proceeded to repair all the 220 wiring in the village when he wasn't lecturing about family. One found this over and over. The multitude of talents was just almost overwhelming. The Lord provided us, too, with exactly the right people at the right time. We were given a backhoe, which we badly needed to put in new lines, plumbing and sewerage and what have you. And it came, and it was discovered that everyone on the staff thought that the person next to him knew how to run one, and nobody really did. And a day or two later, here was this beautiful big piece of yellow equipment, and it just sat. And so a day or two later, off the bus comes a man, went straight to the backhoe, got on it, and pedaled it around like a kitty car. And when he got the thing stopped and we questioned him, it turned out that he had won the Midwest backhoe contest. He was on his way to the United States contest in Seattle. He had taken a detour to go to Stehekin. While on the boat, he had heard about Holden Village and had gotten off at Lucerne and given up on Stehekin and came up to Holden Village. Another time, we were putting in a electrical power station, turbines, and it was quite an engineering feat to do it, and of course we had no experts in that sort of thing up there. And this one new guest was walking down the road with Carol, and he said, "I like this place." He said, "Is there anything I can do to help? What do you need?" And Carol said, "Well, right now what we need is a hydroelectric engineer." And the man said, "Well, I happen to be a hydroelectric engineer." And it went from there. We started a pot shop. In the meantime, I had gotten quite interested in pottery, having been exposed to it at Holden. And so I took courses during the winter for 2 years in ceramics, and then asked to be transferred from the children's activity to the pot shop. But we needed an outside kiln. We had only a little electric kiln, and it was quite limited in its capacity and in its ability to do the more sophisticated glazes. And so one of the men at the village, I believe he was on the staff, had this background and built this big, beautiful kiln that would use the leftover oil from the various vehicles that we had when we changed oil. This happened over and over. One of the dedications that I most remember, and I wish there was some way it could have been recorded, was Howie Hong, the great philosopher and translator of Kierkegaard, along with Edna, dedicated the new sewage system, and in all seriousness said that this was the one place in the village where the plumbers, the ditch diggers, and the theologians all met on a common ground. Paul Hain came early on in the first few years, along with Julie, and he was a Missouri Synod pastor with a PhD in economics, which made an unusual combination. But I remember that the first time we had communion, open communion for everyone in the village, he officiated. As far as I know, this is the first time that Missouri Synod pastor shared the common cup with everyone, and it eventually came to happen on a broader scale, but I think Holden was the first place. We had such a wealth of music. The Lutheran Church is so rich in music, with Bach as its background, and we had the timpanist from the Seattle Symphony, who later became director of, the Minneapolis Symphony, later became director of Minneapolis Opera. He was just loaded with talent and great fun. All of the people that Carol managed to attract to the village were top-notch communicators, and they made everything so exciting and so alive for the rest of us. The Kemmerers came in, I believe, 72, and he was, is, well-known in stained glass, and also an excellent oil painter. And his father taught homiletics in the seminary for many years, so he and Liz both had a heavy theological background, and he would relate his art to, every morning after breakfast, to whatever matins had been, the Bible study that Carol had given that morning. It was so wonderful to see the talents of the various fields tied in to theology. In our secular life, we tend to separate it so, and here it all became one and meshed, as indeed I think it should be. Don Wilson came one summer. He again, was one of these very talented people, and he had written a musical called Skits and Songs, The World... Skits and Songs and Things Right and Wrong with the World, the Church, and You. This was our first full-scale musical, and it was great. The first summer, and perhaps even the second, we were going on oil that supplied the electricity for the village, and that got to be very expensive, having to haul it up so far. So all the lights went out at 9 o'clock. There were times when it was inconvenient, but for the most part, it was great. The village was silent. It was dark. We tended to go to bed early or else go to the sauna. And later, we found we missed that when we had lights all the time. So now and then, in the summer, we would have an evening of silence. All the lights would go out, and there was no talking. It was an experience that one almost had to go through in order to appreciate it. Another large event in the village every night was volleyball after the evening meal. This enabled, as Carol often said, everyone to work off their frustrations. And there were, of course, frustrations with all of us living so closely in such a remote area. But the volleyball was hot and heavy, and one found that it did get rid of all the frustrations when you could smash the ball down over the net. One of the large things to me about the village was the crafts, the arts and crafts, which probably shouldn't be lumped together, but nevertheless often are. It allowed many of us to be exposed to things. Gertrude Lundholm was especially involved in this and did a great job, that we would not ordinarily think about at home, or if we did, it would require acquiring a great deal of equipment and going to classes and so on. Where here, we could try out various things and find out if we liked them and then continue them at home. I was exposed for the first time in my life to weaving there, along with ceramics, and got very interested in it and bought a loom and continued to this day my spinning and weaving. This was true in so many areas, whether it was the rock shop or sketching and watercolors or doing macrame or whatever. People who had never worked with their hands suddenly found that they could do something and that they thoroughly enjoyed it. I remember Mark Matthews, who later became president of California Lutheran College, ducked his head around the corner of the pot shop and asked if there was any way he could just try it. And I said, of course. I sat him down at the wheel. I talked him through a couple of pots, and he made a communion service. Years later, when he became president of CLC, I dropped in to see him, and the first thing he proudly showed me was his communion set that he used with the staff at CLC to have their private communions in his office. Very proud of it. The first and only thing he had ever made with his hands. One of our large projects was Koinonia. There was a large lodge or dormitory, as it was called in the days of the mine, and we gutted it. It was right down next to the village center, and we tore the entire inside out and redid it. We went up on the mountain and we cut lodgepole pine. We got ceiling boards, and we proceeded to make this into a center for lectures and for conversation. Howie Hong built a very large round fireplace, and on the 4th of July, everyone in the village gathered up a laser gun ring rock, and Rudy had to tell us what it was because he was the geologist for the village, and we carried them in, and Howie built the fireplace with them. We had gotten a little over-enthusiastic, I guess, because about half of them had to be hauled out again. The big hood that went over the fireplace was special ordered, and the company who made it said it was the largest hood they had ever made. We were all up on scaffolding, pounding into the ceiling, and if you got a mule track, which is what is left when a hammer misses the nail and hits the wood, the board had to come out and be replaced. No mule tracks were allowed. We skinned the logs and used them as supports for the room, and it turned out to be a lovely, lovely place, and one, the type of thing that Holden Village really needed. Another of our large projects was the mine. Everyone was interested in going up there and seeing what a copper mine had been like. It was a closed mine, of course, one of the very few copper mines. Usually they're open mines. They start at the top of a mountain and circle down. But this had been dug in tunnels, more like a coal mine or a gold mine. And Rudy was instrumental in getting it reestablished as much as possible. The salvage rights had been sold before the Lutheran Church acquired Holden, and the man had taken out the big I-beams and all the things that were worth any money and had not cleaned it up. And as I understand, I'm not sure about this, he took bankruptcy so that they couldn't come back on him and make him clean it up. So Rudy took a group of young people, and their major job for many summers was to clean up and reestablish and to build a mine museum. It took about 20 years for Rudy to finally get his mine museum building built and get it all together. All the records that he had acquired, fortunately, Holden Village was in a very low moisture area, so even the books left on the dirt floors underneath the chalets were not molded and or mildewed, and so he was able to collect all of those. He had one of the big lockers in the hotel filled with all the memorabilia from the mine, which was very fortunate, because when a young man wanted to do his PhD on Holden, it was all there for him. The records were taken down, filled an entire bus, and he took them to the University of Washington and photographed all of them and wrote his thesis, which turned out to be a published book from these records. The old miners' village had been burned the summer before I came, but the scars had not yet healed, and we could go over there and find baby bottles and kitty cars and all kinds of funny things that had been left. It's my understanding from talking to some of the old-timers from the mining days that the people simply couldn't believe after 25 years that the mine would close. And they waited and waited, thinking that it would reopen. And finally it was announced that the last barge was going down, and if people wanted to get their household goods out, they should be on that barge. So many of them left quite hurriedly and took only the essentials with them. In the dining hall, the last meal, the leftovers were simply left on the table The coffee was still in the big urns, which unfortunately rusted them. They're now just pieces to be viewed. They can't be used. And the last man to walk out of the dining room told me what a strange feeling it was to just walk out and know that that it would never be filled again. Many of the old miners didn't want to come back after the church got it because they were afraid their fond memories would be displaced by what we had done. But the ones who did come were so thrilled. They were so glad they had come because we had reestablished the village very carefully and tried to keep it just the way it was. I know many people tried to get Carol to agree to building a chapel so that we could have our worship service in a proper place. We were in the big village center, which also was a basketball court, which also was a stage, a multi-purpose room. In fact, in the days of Lassie, Elizabeth Taylor had appeared on the stage and entertained the miners. I often said I had had the privilege of acting on a stage that had once held Elizabeth Taylor. But Arnie Flotten was a great wood carver, one of the greats, and he came up one summer and offered to build an altar and lectern, and of course we'd have bought any material that he wanted in order for him to build this for us. Instead of that, he went up on the mine level and brought down old railroad ties and proceeded to build an altar that had no nails in it. It was in the shape of an ark, and it could be dismantled and moved in pieces and reassembled. And he did the carving on the wood. It was just, everything was made to fit, to not clash. But getting back to the chapel, Carol said no, and I think rightly so, that the worship should take place in the midst of where we were living. And it has remained that way ever since. We had difficulty at first, and still to a certain extent do. Churches were accustomed to Bible camps. They did not know what an adult retreat was, really. They're quite well known in Europe. They're also used extensively in the Catholic Church. But in the Protestant churches of this country, mostly when we have church groups, it's a Bible camp. And the idea of an adult retreat was somewhat foreign. We tried to discourage people from calling it Holden Camp to get away from the Bible camp idea. People who came were intrigued with the idea of families. No one under 18 was allowed without their parents, and they found that an adult retreat was something that they very much needed in their lives. Not only myself, but so many people with whom I've talked said that coming to Holden filled the empty spaces, the worn out parts, that and sort of revved them up and kept them going for the next year. Also, many people took back a new concept to their home congregations, using many of the flavor, the ideas, the things that they found at Holden that were so important to their worship life and to their everyday life. I don't know of a place or a people who changed so many lives, who sort of turned them upside down and reassembled them for the better. A whole courses of lives were changed, professional and personal. One of the nostalgic memories of Holden are the wonderful carillons every morning. Beanie started that after we got our electric organ. And to be awakened in that mountain setting with the clear, cool air, looking forward with great anticipation to what would happen that day to the people who were there. And Beanie's carillons were just something very, very special. You could tell what was going on by what he chose to play in the mornings. Few of us could stand to miss the carillons, and it got us out of bed with a smile and a bounce to our steps. Beanie had another capacity. I heard a musician say you could tell what the text of a hymn was, the various verses, by the way Beanie played the music. The words were very important to him, and in his talks to groups of pastors who came up about the music portion of worship was that so many pastors failed to be aware of the text, that their biggest decision was whether to play verses 1, 3, and 5, or 2, 4, and 6. We had auctions at Holden, and these were always great fun. When Werner was particularly inspired, he was the best auctioneer I have ever heard. One time, one young man from Amarillo, Texas, had the concession for the Kauai pianos, and so he offered a piano to the village at wholesale. I think he offered to pay transportation on it. Anyway, it was quite a generous gift. And the piano was going to run, don't hold me to this, but as I recall, around $10,000. And so we started in. The auction was that people would bid what they wanted to give to help with the piano. Amazing, and I think Werner was as amazed as the rest of us. In one short portion of an evening, the entire amount was raised to buy the piano. This happened on several occasions with various things from Herb Brokering's original poetry on. I think Carol even donated his red coat that he wore in the 4th of July parade every year to be auctioned. I know that money was a problem in the early days at Holden. We certainly had very little outside support. The faculty not only donated their time and their energies, but also helped keep the coffers filled. Carol was the one who had to worry about collecting the money, and he slogged through the snows of Minnesota and slept in basements and managed to get enough together to keep us all going. But we weren't aware of this, really. There was no great emphasis on money. It was as if the Lord wanted us to have this place, we would find some way to finance it. So the financing was kept at a minimum, and yet it flowed, it came. People with hearts so full of gratitude for what they had experienced there, the changes in their lives and in their entire outlook, that they were most generous in their contributions. The first summer we established the snack bar in the village center. I think it had been something similar in the days of the mine. And just before the 4th of July, we got a soft ice cream machine. We were pretty short of these little luxuries at Holden, so that was quite an event to get ice cream at Holden Village. The morning of the 3rd of July, the barge came in carrying the big milk cans full of the mix that went into the ice cream machine. And at the dock, they were handing it over from the barge onto the dock, and the person receiving it, standing on the dock, caught hold of the lid instead of the handles of the milk can and ended up holding the can up in the air and or the lid up in the air and the can going down into the waters of Lake Chelan. It was our only can of mix, and we stood there watching it settle to the bottom with all this beautiful unmixed ice cream floating out into the water. The expressions on the faces were something to be recorded. Another couple who made quite an impact on Holden were Mary and Horty Chrisman. Horty was sort of a handyman. He could do any number of things, but mostly he was the barber and the village philosopher. I don't know when I have known a man with such native inborn wisdom and gentleness as Horty. I think everyone loved him. I was abroad visiting third world countries in very remote areas in 1971 and 2, and I visited several missionaries in Southeast Asia and Africa and came back to the village with the idea that these missionaries, some of them were so isolated and so hungry for some sort of outside word, that might be a good thing if the village recorded some of these great lectures that we were hearing every summer and offered them to the mission field. The idea was taken up, and a sound system, rather primitive in those days. I think since then it's become rather sophisticated. But at any rate, we did record a number of the lectures, and then the list of missionaries was located, and letters were sent inviting them to let us know if they wanted any of these lectures. I think a total of 2 missionaries responded in the affirmative, and that was rather disappointing. My great idea didn't count for much, but it did start the tape collection at Holden Village, which later grew and grew and has become a very vital part. So many people who have gone up there, either who were not able to hear certain lectures and wanted to have them, or who had heard them and wanted to be able to take them home and listen to them again. The one summer I stayed into the fall was a revelation. I've never seen anything as beautiful as the fall at Holden. You would start out on the trail up to Heart Lake, and it was like a path laid out for a queen. All the bracken turned bronze and copper and brass, and the dogwoods turned into mottled leather. The beautiful cottonwoods turned all colors, and to stand at the foot of Heart Lake Falls and look up and then climb to the top of the falls and see miles of this beautiful fall color was just breathtaking. Another experience that I had that was rather unique: the first summer, Rudy and some others went up to a place called Dumkey Lake, and they rented a boat, and they had very good fishing. So I asked Rudy before he went if he would reserve a boat for me for the next weekend. So he came back, and I said, "Did you reserve my boat?" And he said, "Well, I'm not really sure." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, there's an old trapper up there named Gordon Stewart, and when I told him Mrs. Swihart was coming up the following weekend and wanted a boat to go fishing, He said, "What? A woman? She'll spoil the reputation of my lake." At any rate, I put on my backpack, and it was rather heavy because I was going up alone, and I had all the cooking equipment and everything in the one backpack. Coming down the rather steep incline from the path to Gordon's cottage, where the boats were kept, or cabin, this huge dog bounded out of the forest, a Weimaraner, and raced straight toward me. I backed up a step or two, tripped, and with the weight of the backpack fell flat on my back. The dog leaped up and straddled me with all four legs and started licking my face. I was trying to push the dog away so I could manage to get back on my feet, and I heard this voice from the forest saying, "Don't pet my dog." Well, the Hinderly children rather set an example for all the young people at Holden. That's such an outstanding family. I don't know when I've been so impressed with young adults as those who have gathered at Holden over the years. Howard and Loretta Gilling were another couple who gave much to the village. Howard, of course, being our CPA, and Loretta being the great cookie baker. She comes up with months of work of cookies for the Christmases at Holden, and they are made with love and accepted with love. Elmer and Jenny Witt were another couple. I remember when I first got to know them thinking if Carol ever left the directorship of Holden, they would be a unique couple to take it over. It was many years later, 1984, that Elmer was chosen to be director. Alas, by that time Jenny was no longer with him, and we miss her. The relationships at Holden in this day of throwaway paper goods and throwaway plastic goods and throwaway relationships are unique. Many of us who met over 20 years ago are still in contact, and the feelings run very precious and very deep. My husband and I, when he retired, moved to Leavenworth. Unfortunately, he lived only 2 years after moving here, but at least we did get here. Oklahoma was sort of a desert as far as Holden was concerned. The only other Holden people we saw were the ones who stopped on their way through, back and forth, from one coast to the other. In Leavenworth, the John Reekes, I believe, started it, John and Karen. They moved here when they left Holden Village, and then over the years have come Karen Strum, the Dick and Millie Wiederanders, Fritz and Gertrude Norstad. Arnie Ohawks served for a time as pastor of the Lutheran Church here in Leavenworth. Werner and Judy Jansen moved here to a house they bought some years ago when he retired as business manager of Holden. And Bill and Carol Lehman have built a retirement home here and are awaiting the day when they can move into it. Rich and Liz Kemmerer and their family moved. They started the Grunewald Guild north of Leavenworth, and their son, Dave Kemmerer, also has a residence here. Mark Schramm, the son of John and Mary Schramm, who were the second directors of Holden, has remained in Leavenworth. Reed Carlson and his brother Kurt, Greg and Mary Stieber, he's our local doctor. The Newell Arnsons, who helped start the church here after it had closed for some years. Lisa Broker from Holden, married and lives north of here. And of course, Jean and Al Swihart. In closing, I would like to apologize, really, although I don't think it's possible to really describe Holden Village to anyone. It isn't so much a place as it is an experience. It's an experience which one can talk about, but not really understand until you've experienced it. At any rate, thank you everyone who has made the village so precious to so many.